From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, change your aura, change your life. Here's what's happening. Wow. That's just about all I can say. Wow. Donald Trump completed a five-state sweep in tonight's Republican presidential primaries, strengthening his shot at avoiding a contested convention, while Hillary Clinton scored convincing victories but was denied the same bragging rights of a primary sweep by a surprised Bernie Sanders, who won in Rhode Island. Of the two front runners, Clinton, who won four states Tuesday, remains closer to clinching the nomination. She now has nearly 90% of the delegates needed to secure the party's nod, even as Sanders vows to keep fighting. On the Republican side, Texas Senator Ted Cruz and the Ohio Governor John Kasich still can potentially hold Trump under 1,237 delegates that he needs. But the billionaire businessman Super Tuesday number three run of the table reinforces his aura of invincibility going into the next round. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Well, John, not a bad showing today for Mr. Trump.
No, I mean, he really ran the table as we all predicted that he would. But here's the thing, the collision course right now, George, between news analysis and conspiracy. You have a cadre out there, and Trump has alluded to it, a cadre led by, yes, disgruntled former candidates,
yes,
like Jeb Bush. You've got Lindsey Graham. You've got Mitt Romney out there. There's a whole cadre of them, coordinated, orchestrated, it appears, by Rince Priebus and the Republican National Committee. And this, what Trump has called collusion, is far more than collusion. We have never seen this before in a primary process where candidates are, you know, gaming, you know, engaging in all kinds of subterfuge in order to deny somebody. This man, Trump, is a juggernaut like Ronald Reagan was in 1980. This is the kind of candidate that they want. I mean, you hear bits and pieces from Kasich saying, oh, well, the polling shows that I, you know, compete better against Hillary Clinton. Well, this hypothetical polling is worthless. Trump has won the lion's share of these primaries. He is piling up these delegates right now, close to 1,000. I think he's well over on his way to potentially, you know, taking this. And yet this cadre that is beneath the surface right now, orchestrating things from, you know, the God knows where, is trying to sabotage him. They have a candidate that they should be very pleased with, that they can, you know, run this horse all the way to the White House, and yet they're trying to sabotage him.
Well, they better change and change fast, John, because we'll see what happens as Trump starts. You know, I've been saying all along, brokered convention. But tonight's showing was pretty dramatic. We'll see what happens in the next couple more primaries. With flowers, candles, anger, tears, Ukraine marked the 30th anniversary of the explosion at the Chernobyl nuclear plant, the world's worst accident. Some survivors said the chaos of that time is etched in their minds forever. About 600,000 people, often referred to as Chernobyl's liquidators, were sent in to fight the fire at the plant and clean up the worst of its contamination. 30 workers died, either from the explosion or from the acute radiation sickness within several months. The accident exposed millions in the region to dangerous levels of radiation and forced a wide-scale permanent evacuation of hundreds of towns and villages in Ukraine and Belarus. A very strange birth defect is on the rise in the United States. Scientists are at a loss to explain it. They're baffled. The birth defect causes a baby's intestines to protrude outside of his or her body through a hole in the abdominal wall right beside the belly button. Sometimes this hole is very small, but it can also be quite large, and other organs such as the stomach and liver can extend from the baby's body outside. Very strange. They don't know what's happening. An Arizona woman accused of faking a cancer diagnosis to get the state to pay for her late-term abortion was convicted of fraud and other charges. Maricopa County Superior Court officials said the jurors found Jalice Renee Zeitner guilty of all 11 counts. What a story that was. Prince's sister says the superstar musician had no known will when he died. And she's filed paperwork asking a Minneapolis court to appoint a special administrator to oversee his estate. A Dutchman dubbed the horror dentist by the French media has been sentenced to 8 years in jail for mutilating patients' mouths and defrauding Social Security services there. He was pulling teeth like crazy when somebody would go in for a general routine. This is like a horror film. Apple, their smartphone woes are deepening. The company posted its first quarterly drop in revenue in more than a decade and forecast another decline in the current period, dragged down by waning demand for the iPhone as fewer users race to snap up the latest version of that device. Listen to this. It may be the stuff of science fiction films, but new research has found that 1 in 4 young people in the United Kingdom would happily date a robot. I'm not kidding. The only caveats, according to the survey of 18 to 34-year-olds, is that their Android beau must be a perfect match and must look like a real human being. I saw this story today, and I thought, there's only one guy I can call to get his reaction to it, and that's Howard Bloom. Howard, this is bizarre.
It's bizarre, but it's less bizarre than you might think. Look, men have a problem that we never talk about in polite company. It is a vast oversupply of sexual need, and it's a painful supply of social need. I mean, men in college dormitories will howl during the weekends, "I'm so lonely I could die," in chorus. Meanwhile, women dole out sex in measured, meager doses, and there's a reason. For a woman, sex leads to pregnancy, and pregnancy is a 20-year commitment. So a woman has to be cautious. For a man, sex is a whole different thing. It can be as little as a 2-hour stand, maybe even a 20-minute stand. Then a man can pick up, move on, and never be bothered again. The bottom line is that women are picky and men are not, and that's the basic insight of evolutionary psychology. It's the, you've experienced this. I've experienced that. This evolutionary psychology is now 50 years old. So men have sexual desire coming out of their ears, but women do not, which is where sexual robots come in. Sexual robots would solve the problem of male surplus need.
This is going to happen, isn't it?
Yes, it's happening. I mean, it's happening so fast that in China, it's a $15 billion market right now. Elderly Chinese women are buying they're still too primitive to be called sexual robots. They're advanced sexual toys for their husbands because you don't stop being sexual when you're 70 or when you're 80 or when you're 90. But who wants to sleep with you? Nobody. a man with cancer has married a robot because he didn't want to leave a grieving widow. Not that he could have found a woman to marry him.
Do you see the day where somebody's going to take a robot out to dinner?
Well, that's what the guys who are designing these things are out for.
Take her to a fast food place. She won't know the difference.
Yeah. Oh, well, no. They want a robot that you relate to totally, who senses your needs, who clues into your desires, who does everything that a real woman, remember, relationships, real relationships, we talked about this before, are one of the hardest things on planet Earth. But the guys designing these new sexual robots are designing the robot of your dreams.
Unbelievable.
Which do you think you'll end up taking out for dinner in the end? Your robot.
I've got an assignment for you. I want you to find the robot company, and we're both going to interview the guy who created them. Okay?
That would be terrific. Okay.
You got it. Howard Bloom. Robots. A Labrador has been honored as a hero for rescuing 7 people in the aftermath of the devastating earthquake in Ecuador last week, before dying from exhaustion at the age of 4. This little dog named Deco worked with the fire service out there, spent several days searching for survivors after the magnitude 7.8 earthquake that killed 654 people, injured 2,000 more. This dog did not stop searching for people and survivors, worked so hard, then he basically died of a heart attack. Up next, there's so many things going on this planet. It's time to bring in Roger Stone. He, of course, is a noted author. A couple of his books, The Clintons' War on Women, Jeb and the Bush Crime Family, But we're going to talk with Roger about what's going on today and some other thoughts that he's been working on next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, turn off your television because we've got quite a night for you tonight. Roger Stone back with us, a seasoned political operative, a pundit, a veteran of 9 presidential campaigns, the latest being Donald Trump. He also served as a senior campaign aide to 3 Republican presidents. Very well-known voice in politics for more than 40 years. We're not going to just talk politics. We don't just do that. Roger gives insights all over the place. He's on Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC. Always a privilege. Roger, welcome back.
Delighted to be with you. At least 2 of those news organizations have recently banned me.
That's what I heard.
Which is some kind of Soviet-style repression. I mean, it's particularly bad in the case of CNN, George, because they allow Ted Cruz to attack me by name, and then they don't afford me the opportunity to respond.
That's right. He called you the dirty trickster, right?
Yeah, well, it takes one to know one, and I'm not running for president. I mean, I've seen his kind before. He's a very shifty character with a Wall Street background. He's the toast of the insiders. He's funded by Wall Street and by the oil and gas industry. His wife has deep ties to the Bush administration, to Condoleezza Rice as her deputy, then the deputy to Robert Zoellick, who goes to the World Bank, who basically pushes through these international TPP, TPA trade deals. He's the father of TPA. He then takes Heidi Cruz to Goldman Sachs, where she's working on Wall Street as a banker. And, of course, Goldman Sachs gives Ted Cruz $1 million secret sweetheart loan to fund his Senate race.
That must be nice.
So, this guy is he's a Bush Republican. He was George W. Bush's brain. He was George W. Bush's issues man in the year he ran for president and about half the first year of his presidency.
I've got to get your take on just what is going on today, Roger, with the campaign, primarily the Republican one. I want to ask you about Hillary as well, but I mean, Trump taking 5 states tonight, people are going crazy about this.
I have never, any time in the 40 years roughly that I've been in American politics, I have never seen the voters in this sour or this angry a mood. Voters are really angry and they're fed up with a system they perceive to be broken.
Mm-hmm.
They perceive to be rigged against the common man. They believe correctly that everything is purchased by the special interests, the lobbyists, and so on, whether it's domestic policy and defense contracts or foreign policy and endless war. They think that both parties have really become one party, the Wall Street Party, the Special Interest Party,
yep,
the party of the elites, the party of both parties controlled by the globalists.
Aren't they right? But they're right.
They're absolutely correct. No, I mean, look, I have a great sentimental attachment to the old Republican Party of Barry Goldwater. That was the small government out of my life, out of my pocket, a libertarian strain of Republican. That Republican Party no longer exists. Today we have the plastic party of Mitt Romney, funded by Wall Street. It is not the mainstream Republican Party that we last had under Ronald Reagan.
What happened to it? How did it get away from them?
The Bushes hijacked it, in all essence. George H.W. Bush ran for the 3rd term of Reagan. Reagan left very popular. Then he betrayed Reaganism by raising taxes. Remember, read my lips.
Oh, yeah.
Taxes.
Oh, yeah.
He also went out and pursued all kinds of adventures in Central America as vice president and then later as president. He ended up pardoning Caspar Weinberger to cover up his own role in drug dealing and drug trafficking, which the government was involved in after the Congress cut off funding for the Nicaraguan rebels. George Bush Sr. headed a task force, interagency tax force, to come up with ways to finance, illegally in this case, the Nicaraguan rebels. We were importing millions and millions of dollars worth of cocaine into these rural airports in the southern United States, the most busy one being Mena, Arkansas, where they had a friendly local governor who was more than happy take his cut and tell the state police to look the other way. That would be William Jefferson Clinton.
Unbelievable. Now, you're making these incredible accusations. How come nobody tries to sue you?
Well, first of all, if you look at the historical record, when the special prosecutor appointed by the Attorney General seeks to question Vice President Bush about the entire drug running operation, he refuses to cooperate with the inquiry. He stonewalls it, will not be interviewed, nor will he turn over any files. He does this on the advice of his lawyer. That's how he avoided being indicted when Oliver North was indicted in Iran-Contra. But the Bushes and the Clintons worked to traffic millions of dollars of drugs into the country. The story got spiked at the Washington Post when it was written by Roger Morris, very fine reporter, very credible reporter.
He had it ready to go, didn't he?
Yes, indeed. It is just one of the many intersections between the Clintons and the Bushes, which is odd.
So here we are at a point, Roger, where people, as you say, and I've been saying this for 3 years, are simply fed up. The erosion of the middle class has now got a voice, and they've got that voice through Donald Trump, of all people. And they are supporting him in droves. And it looks like, even though I've said before, brokered convention in the Cruz and Kasich and everybody else are going to do the best they can to make it that way, the public, the people, they wanted Donald Trump, don't they?
Yeah, this has been an extraordinary performance, particularly when you consider that he elected a communications-based strategy, where he thought that doing these giant rallies in the various states, getting wall-to-wall cable and network coverage, plus the debates that got huge audiences, plus as many television interviews as he seems to be able to smash into a day, that could outweigh the $40, $50 million in negative advertising, paid negative advertising, targeting him. And I never would have believed it, but he so saturated the news cycles that this paid off. So he didn't have to build the kind of traditional grassroots campaign. This was Trump mania. I mean, he swept these primaries with a convention strategy. Now, unfortunately, as the campaign kind of showed in Wisconsin and North Dakota and Colorado and other places, the party bosses are trying to pick off a delegate here and pick off a delegate there. But as you point out, whenever it goes to the people, as it did today, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, I mean, these are Connecticut. These are delegate-rich states where Trump has really performed over 50%, I believe, in every contest, which is extraordinary. You know, the naysayers used to say, oh, Trump has a ceiling, he can't get me up below the middle 30s. That's entirely wrong. He is on his way to being the nominee. What you refer to, though, as a brokered convention is still possible, even if Trump gets 1,237 delegates. He could have enough delegates to be nominated on the first ballot, but at the same time, because the Republican machines have been inserting non-Trump supporters into the Trump delegate, the anti-Trump forces could have a majority on questions of rules or credentials.
Right there. Oh, my gosh.
And that is where, and that's where the big steal goes down. In other words, here's how it works. The committee, the rules committee, passes a rule, let's just say hypothetically, that it unseats any delegate who was elected with the votes of non-Republicans. Well, that's a matter of state rules, but in South Carolina, for example, you can show up at the polls, be a Democrat, and vote in the Republican primary.
Right.
And then you're re-enrolled in the books as a Republican. In states like New Hampshire, you have to go through filling out a form and filing it before you, and switch parties formally before you can vote. This would have the effect of throwing out all the Massachusetts and all the South Carolina delegates that were Donald Trump supporters. That would break the back of his slim majority. Now, that has to go to a vote for a vote to the full convention for ratification. And that's where the showdown vote is. These Trojan horse delegates, I've written out,
and that's exactly what they are.
My own website. This could really be a problem for Donald Trump.
All right, stay with us. So, Roger, we're going to come back. I want to chat with you about your work in investigating the JFK assassination, because folks are going to hear something that could be very startling there as well, and so much more on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Roger Stone with us as we get into all kinds of fascinating things. Roger, I want to ask you this too. You were one of Donald Trump's top advisors, left the campaign. They say they may have pushed you out. Can you tell us what happened? Because you're still a Trump supporter, aren't you?
Yeah, very strongly. Now, that's an inaccurate description of what happened. It became very clear to me very early on that Donald had his own vision of how to do this. And I was skeptical that an all communications-based strategy with no paid media, no sophisticated polling, no targeting, no modeling, no television commercials, no radio commercials, no direct mail, no phone calls. I was skeptical that that could work. I was proved wrong. But a campaign can only have one strategist, and Donald Trump is his own strategist. And his strategy has turned out to be brilliant. His sense of entertainment and spectacle and his persona have attracted hundreds of thousands of Democrats and independents and young people to his candidacy. And I think it is because the rise of Trump is a repudiation of 30 years of failed policies, whether it's Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, everything remains the same. Endless war, erosion of our civil liberties, massive bank bailouts, spending and borrowing us into oblivion, high taxes on working people, easy taxes on Wall Street. It's endless. At a minimum, a foreign policy that is completely incoherent. I'm not even sure, other than punishing our friends and rewarding our enemies, I'm not clear what we do. So I think people are sick of that. Now, both the New York Times and Politico confirmed that I showed at least four sources my resignation letter. Mm-hmm. And it was great sadness that I resigned, because I have wanted Trump to run for president since 1988. And I tried to get him to run again in 2000. I was the chairman of his presidential exploratory committee. I have great affection for Donald Trump and his family. I knew his parents very well. I know Melania very well. I have great respect for Ivanka and his other children, who I think have been very effective on the stump for their father. And I remain a strong Trump supporter. But frankly, I think, in all honesty, I can do more for him from the outside. That's why I have been organizing the Stop the Steal march and rally in Cleveland. We're trying to build the biggest outdoor, peaceful, nonviolent protest. We have a permit from the city of Cleveland. We have mapped out a march route that the police have approved. The idea here is numbers. We want to be strong. We want to dominate Cleveland. You can go to stopthesteal.org if you're more interested. But that is something I could never do if I were formally involved in the campaign.
Do you think he originally got involved just because he's Donald Trump and he wanted to do this and see what would happen and get his name out, and then all of a sudden he realizes, my God, I could win this thing?
Well, I mean, that's the great thing about Trump. He is supremely confident. I mean, he is a can-do guy. He's an optimist by nature. He is very, very tough. I mean, he is tough as nails. There are jokes about ice water in his veins. He's the guy I want to send to negotiate with the Chinese.
Yeah.
He's the guy I want to negotiate with the Chinese. This guy is brutal when it comes to his adversaries, and those countries have been taking us to the cleaners for too long. You know who negotiated the Iran deal? A social worker, not even a diplomat.
Unbelievable. No, I guess it is believable now when you look at what's been going on over all these years. So you still stay friends, and he's got a good chance of winning.
Look, I'm very pleased about some of the changes he made in his campaign. I became very concerned when he lost Wisconsin, then got outfoxed in North Dakota, then Colorado. Shortly before that, Louisiana had blown up. I predict you're going to have more problems in other states. There are issues in Georgia. There are issues in South Carolina. The party establishment types, the Bush-Romney-Cruz group, because Cruz is really a globalist. He is one of them. He poses as a constitutional conservative, and I have to admit a lot of the stuff he says is appealing to me, although he himself reminds me of Grandpa Munster. And his voice is almost identical to Mr. Haney on Green Acres.
I used to do Haney impressions when I was a kid, too.
I mean, I'm surprised that the late Pat Buttram's estate is not suing Ted Cruz.
That's fine.
For unauthorized use of the voice.
Mr. Douglas, would you like to buy something?
There you go.
Remember that? So, can Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton?
I think he's actually the only one that can beat her, because you have to be entirely fearless. In other words, there can be no pulling of punches here. Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, and I think John Kasich all said that Bill Clinton's sexual history is off the table. It's irrelevant. And the reason it is not irrelevant is because Hillary's role in covering up those crimes, Hillary's role in threatening and bullying and intimidating Bill's numerous victims. And that makes it very relevant, because she's an accessory after the fact in those crimes. And the mainstream media just doesn't want to talk about this. When Steve Malzberg or Kurt Schliester or some conservative commentator begins to talk about Hillary's epic abuse of numerous women, CNN unplugs them. They pull out the plug on their microphones. More Soviet-style censorship.
Yeah. Why do they do that? Why pull the plug?
Because they are really the Clinton News Network, and very sadly, this narrative upsets the entire apple cart. Remember, Hillary's entire candidacy is based on an assumption that she can get a vastly disproportionate number of votes from women. What happens when young women who don't know anything about her learn that she authorized private detectives to threaten the children, kill the pets of, break into the homes of, slash the tires of, smash the windshields of various women to terrorize them out of testifying against her husband? She is the one who runs the sluts and nuts operation to smear Monica Lewinsky as a slut, as a little nut, as if it's Lewinsky's fault that she is seduced by a president three times her age. I mean, George, I want to be very clear. My book is not about consensual sex, marital infidelity, adultery, girlfriends, mistresses. If I wrote such a book about Bill Clinton, it would be a 12-volume encyclopedia.
Oh.
This guy has literally been with thousands of women. But I focus very narrowly on sexual assault, because I think that crosses a line. And if Bill Cosby can be prosecuted, and I think he should be, Bill Clinton should be prosecuted. The feminist writer, a very famous feminist writer, wrote this in the Boston Herald not long ago.
We shall see what happens there, because I have a feeling that Mr. Trump will take off the gloves if he has to.
Well, I mean, look, you got to go at her on her abuse of women. You have to go at her on her failed tenure as Secretary of State, particularly the takedown in Libya. Let's take the average woman in Libya. Under Gaddafi, a woman could own property, go to college, choose her own husband, get as much education as she desired.
Drive a car.
Drive a car. If she was raped, her rapist would be prosecuted. Now, under Sharia law, none of those things are legal. Women cannot even go out in public without a veil.
And
Hillary
what?
Clinton,
children
Hillary
are being
Clinton,
married off.
Right. Hillary Clinton has put women in Libya back 200 years. Yeah, I think there's going to be a discussion about that.
One of your other books, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, absolutely riveting book. Absolutely riveting. Let's talk a little bit about this. And how much
is
suppressed?
One of the reasons why I have great reverence for Coast to Coast, because Coast to Coast really put this book on the map. This was the second highest-selling book on the Kennedy assassination, second only to Bill O'Reilly's piece of fiction, and he has a TV show to promote. So
that's
I was
right.
Very, very grateful and excited about that.
Well, you did a great job.
The book is a New York Times bestseller, and it's very simple. And that is that the entire story of the murder of Kennedy is more complex. So those who say, like Jim Douglas, who say the CIA did it, or those who say the mob did it, or those who say Big Texas Oil did it, or those who say the central bankers did it, they're all correct. But Lyndon Baines Johnson is the linchpin. He is the guy who controls the Dallas Police Department and the Dallas District Attorney, and they have jurisdiction over the investigation. In 1963, murder of the president is not a federal crime. It's a state crime.
It's a state crime.
So Johnson
right.
controls the investigation from the get-go. Each one of these players has their own motive. In Johnson's case, He is facing indictment by the Justice Department for his role in the Bobby Baker and Billy Saul Estes scandal. So he's not just facing political oblivion. He knows his rival, Robert Kennedy, is about to put him in prison. And he's running out of time. Lyndon Johnson knows that that Time Life has 9 investigative reporters on the ground looking into how he became a rich man in Texas, and that is going to be a cover story on December 1st.
They probably would have waited until that the first term of Kennedy was over, and Kennedy would not have picked Johnson as his running mate, and then bang, they indict him.
Well, Johnson had clearly gotten the message because JFK told Evelyn Lincoln, his personal secretary, the night before he left for Dallas, that Johnson would not be on the ticket.
He didn't
know who he was going to pick. He thought of the possibility of Terry Sanford, who was then governor, later senator from North Carolina. But more importantly, Robert Kennedy had begun telling people in the party that don't worry about LBJ, we're dropping him. He's going to prison. Johnson knew that Kennedy's Justice Department was feeding the Time magazine reporters. In fact, Johnson knew that on the 23rd of November, Drew Pearson, the most powerful columnist in America at that time, had a column accusing Johnson of taking a $10,000 bribe to deliver a defense contract to General Dynamics, the TFX jet. As you know, in 1963, a $10,000 bribe is an enormous amount of money. So that's the beginning of the end for LBJ. He has to move. This is why he's the one who suggests that Kennedy go to Dallas. It is his leg man, John Connolly, who dictates the route through Dealey Plaza. Kennedy's advance man object, and they are overruled. Johnson has motive, means, and opportunity. The Central Intelligence Agency is upset about both the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis, because they know the truth, which is that we remove our missiles from Turkey and Italy in a secret deal that the Kennedys had with Khrushchev that was classified for 40 years. So we didn't back him down. The Russian missiles likely never left Cuba. So the CIA is seething about both of those things, as the entire military-industrial complex. The mob feels that they've been double-crossed by JFK. After all, they put $1 million into his elections through a deal brokered by his father,
mm-hmm.
Ambassador Joe Kennedy. And the deal there was that the new Kennedy Justice Department would lay off of Carlos Marcello and Santo Traficante, both of whom the Eisenhower administration was trying to deport. Well, you know what happened. John Kennedy was elected with the help of the mob in Chicago and a few other places. Joe Kennedy Sr. was felled by a stroke that could no longer speak. Robert Kennedy became Attorney General, and he went after the two gangsters with a vengeance.
Yep, they double-crossed him, basically, didn't they?
Yes. This is why Marcello is heard in a wiretap in his prison cell talking about how we got that son of a bitch Kennedy. Now, Ruby, of course, Jack Ruby, is a Marcello, gunsel. He is the front man for the Carousel Club, which is actually owned by Marcello. Ruby is nominally on the license and on the deed, but that's because he is works for the big boss.
So the plot, though, had to have originated a year or two before Kennedy got killed, right?
We know that Lyndon Johnson got his hands on the super secret Secret Service manual on how to guard the president. And had copies made for John Connolly and his law partner, Ed Clark, who most people believe ran the entire operation. You've got a coordinated effort here. Big Texas Oil underwrites this because Kennedy is trying to repeal the oil depletion allowance. I mean, first of all, one needs to understand the character of Lyndon Johnson. He's responsible for numerous murders through his political career. He is responsible for the murder of Henry Marshall, a federal agricultural agent who's investigating Johnson and Billy Saul Estes, is found shot with a bolt action rifle 8 times in the head.
Convenient.
He's most likely murdered by the same man who I believe shoots John Kennedy. As you probably know, a fingerprint found on the cardboard boxes in the so-called sniper's nest is later identified as belonging to Malcolm McWallace, a hitman who at the time of the assassination is working at the U.S. Agriculture Department in a patronage job arranged for him by Lyndon Johnson, who was convicted of murder in 1951, where he killed a man who was dating Lyndon Johnson's sister. He was convicted of first degree murder, and he got a complete walk. He served no time whatsoever. So he was put on probation, where he went to work for a Defense Department company owned by D.H. Byrd, friend of Lyndon Johnson and owner of the Texas.
See, and there are no coincidences, Roger. These things are all done for a reason. Oswald's role, Patsy, as he said he was?
Entirely. It's not possible for Oswald to squeeze off the number of shots required, hide the gun, and run down four flights of stairs to the second floor. It's a wooden staircase. A woman, Victoria Adams, is on the staircase between those floors at the exact time that the Warren Commission says Oswald would have to be racing down the stairs. And remember, it's a wooden staircase. She neither sees nor hears Oswald. It's because he's not there. He's on the second floor. He is seen by a Dallas police officer moments after the shooting. He is not out of breath. He's clearly not run from any place. It's interesting, the electricity in the building has mysteriously gone off, which is why the elevators are no longer working.
Wasn't he like in the kitchen or something, just getting a Coke?
He was getting a Coke in the cafeteria area. So what does he say when they pull him out in public? He says, "I'm a patsy. I didn't shoot anyone." And indeed, for a guy who supposedly shot a leaky Carcano rifle, there's no nitrogen on his chest or his arms or his face. So it is unlikely that he shot anybody. I do think there's multiple shooters. I think the CIA has a shooter team, probably the Corsicans, probably paid shooters. Mm-hmm.
It was a triangular shoot, I believe.
I'm sorry, you cut out there for a moment.
Okay, it was a triangular shoot. They were all over
absolutely.
The place.
Yeah, so Kennedy's clearly shot from the front and back. 25 doctors and nurses at Parkland see and describe a gaping wound in the back of his head that mysteriously disappears by the time his body gets to Bethesda.
Go ahead.
So Johnson has motive, means, and opportunity. He controls the investigation from the get-go. He eventually gets the Texas police to hand it over to the FBI. We tie him to the crime through eyewitness evidence. Six individual people see a man who meets the description of Malcolm Wallace, the hitman who works for LBJ, in the window of the Texas School Book Depository. Three of them tell the FBI. Three of them tell the Dallas police. There is, of course, no follow-up to that. Then you had Richard Carr. Richard Carr is the most unlucky man in the world. He's walking by the Texas School Book Depository building. He sees a man who meets the description of Malcolm Wallace run out of the building, jump into the car, and be driven away by a dark-complected man. Carr made the mistake of telling that to the Dallas police.
Oh.
There was an attempt on his life that very night. There were multiple attempts on his life, so bad that he had to leave Texas. He moved to Montana. And one morning when he went to start his car, he thought to look under the hood, and yet again, there had been a car bomb insulted in his car. So he ultimately returns to Texas, and here's the best part.
Hold on for one second, Roger. We're at the break. We're going to come back for that best part.